The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. You can win €1 million every month with prize bonds.
Let me introduce our guests to you this morning. With us in studio are Minister Brendan Howland, Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, David McWilliams, economist and author of The Good Room, Maureen Gaffney, clinical psychologist, Tom McGurk, broadcaster and columnist, and Stephen O'Byrne, director of MKC Communications. If I start with you, Minister, and please don't talk to me about cabinet confidentiality, was there such a blow-up between Mr Rabbit and Mr Noonan?
I've talked to you about cabinet confidentiality. In truth, don't believe everything you read in the papers. And I don't know where these things come from. If you look at the contents of what's said...
Well, actually, why don't I give the listeners the headlines? Rabbit, keep your nose out of prom note. Well, I read that. Tarnished of vitriol would be laughable if he wasn't making key decisions on our lives. Well, that was a go at you, actually. There's a lot. Labour divided, government in crisis. Pat Rabbit writing in the Sunday Inter says, far from being disappointed by the loss of one, I'm heartened by the resolve of those who stayed.
Well, that's about three different articles, I think.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot about Labour.
That's absolutely true. We have a difficult job in a difficult government at a difficult time. We knew that when the party, I think, had a very big decision to make 18 months ago. The country was on the verge of chaos. That's the truth of it. That was really underscored for us who were involved in the negotiations in the run-up to the formation of the government. When we were briefed by the Department of Finance, as all parties were, about really how precarious our economic situation was. So it would have been much easier to go into opposition, to be the lead party in opposition and to be critical, or to be part of a national government, is what we did. Now, we're a third of a national government. Fine Gael got twice as many deputies and they have twice as many ministers.
Right.
So the programme for government is not our manifesto. Our manifesto is what we would have done with a Labour government, and there are compromises involved.
Can but I come to back to the question, note, though? Did come to the promissory note, which drives people
sure
around the bend. Is there a row between Mr Noonan and Mr Rabbit? I mean, Pat Rabbit was pretty clear on The Week in Politics last Sunday that it wasn't going to be paid.
There is no row because everybody in the Cabinet, as well as everybody in the country, has a vested interest in ensuring that we get a deal on the prom note. I've said from the very beginning of this government, there are three elements to our economic strategy. One, we have to work towards a balanced budget. We can't continue to heap debt upon debt. And everybody knows that. And the only people who are giving us money is the Troika, and it's coming with conditions. So that's, if you like, the balancing the budget bit. The second element is we need a jobs and growth strategy, and we've managed actually to make that a central core of European focus as well as our own domestic focus. I introduced the stimulus package last summer. It's a start. It's $2.25 billion. And the third inescapable element of the strategy is to get a better deal on the awful decision that was made by the previous administration to heap on the backs of the Irish people the debts of a rotten bank.
This point has been made many times.
Yeah.
But Pat Rabbit said definitely last Sunday, we're not paying it. I see Lucinda Creighton saying this isn't terribly helpful, deal hasn't been done, we're all working very hard on it, we're all committed to it.
Well, we are involved in very detailed
discussions. I mean, is Labour saying that under no circumstances will you allow that money to be paid?
I think there's an absolute mood in the country that would be highly resistant to us paying the
problem. That has been there since, let me explain
what we're doing about it.
No, but is that a decision that Labour has made?
You know, it's like you asking me about the detailed discussions that are going on now with the unions on Croke Park.
Yeah.
I'd rather conclude those discussions and then we can just talk about the elements of them. We are engaged with the European Central Bank in particular, but with the Commission and the IMF as well, for a very protracted period of time. None of this is easy. None of this is simple. And, you know, you have the simplistic notions, walk away, don't pay, as if that is a decision that has no consequences. It has very serious consequences.
That's a decision that you have recommended quite a few times, David McWilliams.
The promissory note is a really straightforward one, because what actually happens is the government takes out a little bit over 3 billion, real money every year from the economy, huge amount of money, gives it to the central bank, who then burn it. They actually burn it. I mean, they delete it on the computer, but in terms of visualization, it's like burning money. So It then gets down to, and the minister, I presume, you know, is absolutely right in this, it gets down to a discussion with the European Central Bank.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent the European Central Bank will allow us to what's called monetize debt, right? To actually write the stuff off. Now, it strikes me that over the last, certainly 12 months, there's been a huge change at the ECB. The Draghi administration is totally different to the Trichet administration. Draghi has printed 1 trillion euros to bail out Spain and Italy. Now, 1 trillion euros, you know, if you were to spend 1 million euros, a huge figure, 1 million euros a day, it would take you 2,740 years to spend 1 trillion. So Draghi has indicated that he's a much more flexible individual.
But the David, you had advocated, correct me if I'm wrong, we're not doing it. If necessary, play chicken on it.
Well, I think you have to because, you know, the thing about a balance sheet, the national balance sheet, which is broken by too much debt, you make it better by less debt, not more debt. There's only 3 ways you can do this. One is you grow your way out of it, and we're not doing that.
Not any day soon, anyway.
The other way is you inflate your way out of it, and we're not doing that because we're the Germans won't allow us. And the third way is you negotiate your way out of it. And part of a negotiation has to be the implicit end game that if things don't go right, that there has to be a realistic option for a government to say, hold on a second, this promissory note, take for example, is the Irish government giving the Irish Central Bank money to burn via Anglo-Irish Bank, or the newly titled Irish
IBRC.
IBRC, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's where
not,
we're
at. Not as simple as all that, David. As you know, you can say that it's simply a matter of burning the money.
But that's what happens, Minister, yeah, as you know. And that's the moral and financial and economic.
There's no denying that. The problem is the previous administration borrowed this chunk of money.
But that
was real money. What we're talking about is the scheduled repayments. The debt is gone. That was paid, put into this hole. There are payments that are due every year now. We are determined. We are absolutely determined as a government to undo the deal, the bad deal that the previous administration, and that's what we've been working might and main at, and that's what across the government we're determined to succeed at.
But Brendan, what we're talking about is what Pat Rabbit said. That's the first time I remember a government minister saying we're not paying something. Is that Labour Party policy now? Would you support Rabbit in what he said?
I'm saying that we need to get a deal, and we're working might and main to do that deal. So
you're still not addressing either my question or Tom's.
I'm involved in discussions with the people.
Wait, was your reaction when you heard Pat saying that last week?
I'm saying that he's voicing a view that not only every member of cabinet, but I think every citizen in the country
was. Was he drawing a line in Labour Party policy?
Well, you'll have to wait and see what the line is. And bluntly, I'm saying this to you. The determination will be whether this money is paid in March or not. You can ask the question then.
You've experience now of, it's a long time ago since you were involved now, but you were involved with coalition governments,
sure,
and those kinds of things and bottom lines and all that.
I do think that formally and officially that Pat Rabbit spoke at a turn on Sunday night last. However, I mean, I do think, and clearly I would say there's more than a grain of truth in that headline that you and that where you're probing the minister now. However, I think ironically, we could end up in a better place as a result. I mean, the criticism of the Irish government from David and from lots of other people has been, we've been too compliant. We've been the good boys of Europe. We are the ones who are refusing, like, to put down a, you know, we will go so far but no further. So I think, I think it might actually benefit us in a kind of a good cop, bad cop kind of scenario whereby, you know, Kenny could end up saying, you know, and I'm not saying this is being played like as a pre...
Well, the minister is nodding. I can
No, but I'm just saying, I'm not saying that it's a pre-organised arrangement. But in fairness, if you have a government, if you have a coalition government and one party, in this case it's Labour, you know, put their foot down, I mean, it does present a different kind of dynamic.
I don't want to have it portrayed that there's a party divide on this. There is no member of the current government that is not determined, as I am and Michael Noonan is, to get this squared.
But my point is, I think, that it's, you know, there is no doubt that what Minister Rabbit said a week ago, you know, has caused consternation in other parts of the government. But I'm just saying that the net outcome might actually strengthen Enda Kenny's hand in dealing with Angela Merkel and co.
There is a solution to this which doesn't involve tearing up agreements and walking away, and it's the fact that it involves kicking the promissory note out, not for 10 or 20 years, for 100, for 200 years, because what you've basically, it's a principle. It's not, the issue is not an issue of economics. An issue is the principle, can you monetize, can you not? And if you can get the ECB to do what it's doing all over Europe, it's doing this in Greece, it's doing this in Italy, it's doing it in Spain, which is to look at debt and say, do you know what? Deals that were signed during the boom, whether it was in Italy or Spain or Greece, are actually now, once you enforce them, will make the situation worse. So there is a solution which involves kicking this debt out and negotiating it out and putting it out maybe 200 years. And that would ultimately then take away this crazy situation, which I think everybody around here agrees that when you take 3 billion euros out of an already incredibly fragile economy and you burn it, this is economic nihilism.
But David,
but
can I just...
Yes, Maureen. That word negotiation, you know, that... I mean, it seems to me, you know, it would be kind of almost inconceivable if there weren't, you know, different views on this. And, you know, and I think that's a good thing, you know, that there's tension in cabinet about it, because that keeps the energy and the attention on it. But I mean, essentially, you know, we have to know what we have in the way of, you know, firepower. You know, it's like the 15-year-old going into the bar and saying to the barman, give me a pint or else. And the barman catches him by the collar and says, or else what? And he says, or else a packet of crisps, you know. So, I mean, you know, we have to understand. I mean, I would, you know, put a lot of maybe misplaced faith, you know, in our powers of negotiation. But I think it's not clear to people where we're going. But maybe it's not clear to anyone where anyone is going at this point.
Particularly at this moment that a senior minister should say that is extraordinary, because we are now facing into paying stuff we've never had to pay before.
Yes.
The country is reeling from the bills coming down the way.
Yeah.
And suddenly a senior minister says, we're not paying that. What if people on the ground say, well, I'm not paying my property tax. I'm not paying this, that or the other.
But do you seriously think that the average person takes that much notice? I mean, I don't think they do at all.
Well, that's a different question. But if a senior minister says we're not paying that, I mean, is that a resigning issue? Would he go if they do pay it? He's just sounding off.
I've said from
from
the beginning there are three parts of our economic strategy. I mean, Maureen talks about our negotiating ability. We've done rather well in 18 months. We have greatly reduced the interest rate on the debt we have by 2.5%, where people said we couldn't do that. We have got back the minimum wage. We have got the first stimulus package together. We have got the money from state assets to be used for job creation. You know, we have been doing reasonably well. This is a big challenge, and we need to crack it. We're putting all our efforts and all our energies on a cross-party basis into doing that. And I'm convinced that we can have an agreement on it. But it is obviously much better to do these things by agreement than confrontation, if that can be done.
But I do think, Marion, that, you know, if you go back to the context in which Pat Rabbit said it, and as I say, I see potentially some merit in it. However, you can't ignore the fact that the context in which it actually got said. It got said as a somewhat diversionary tactic away from the internal difficulties within the Labour Party around the whole budget process. Mm. So, you know, there's two dimensions to it, really. You know, as I say, I think at the end of the day, it might help us on the negotiations at the Brussels level. But, you know, I think there is the other dimension that, you know, we're, again, I would have a keen understanding of the way that, you know, there's a lot of fear and loathing within the Labour Party at the moment, particularly after the defection of the party chairman. You know, I can see how that causes immense unease for ordinary backbench deputies, because you're down the country this weekend and you're up to the Keaveney's departure. You can say, well, look, we've got to hang in there. We're standing by the party and so forth. Now you'll have, Keaveney's behaviour or his actions thrown back at you. Why can't you do like the party chairman did? Why can't you have a bit of backbone like him? Why can't you walk too? So, I mean, it creates immense difficulties internally for the Labour Party. And I don't, you know, this is just, that's politics.
But on the other hand, though, it seems to me that... Like two things. One is that I think there's an awful lot of attention at the moment on, you know, particularly the whole symbolic thing of the carers. I mean, it's more than symbolic for them. And I personally think that was a major own goal, you know, for the sake of the amount of money they're getting in, because most people know what an awful life it is, you know, to care for someone with a disability or Alzheimer's or something. I think that was an own goal. I think they could have got the money some other way. The second thing is that it seems to me that where the real time bomb is the bit of personal debt, you know. And I don't think, and I think the property tax, I think where people may live, you know, may sort of eventually come to live with it, you know, like the rest of Europe. But I do think what people are not paying attention to is the cohort of people, you know, who bought in the boom, who are absolutely at the pinnacle of
and there are cases,
and their parents
please.
Who went guarantor for them and all of that. You know, I was interested when I saw the Irish Times poll recently. There was kind of a whole lot of small things. None of them are particularly statistically significant, but I thought they were actually, you know, really painting a picture. You know, that the people in Leinster, outside of Dublin, which is the large commuter belt, I suppose, you know, the bread roll men, as you might say, David, you know. But, you
breakfast
know, they
roll.
Were breakfast roll,
right.
Yes.
We're
yeah, yeah.
Use these expressions, get them right.
But, you know, they were the people who were the least happy, you know, the most stressed, and the people who felt most on their own, I think, about things. And I think they are a time bomb. You know, that people who have
can
all
I
that
ask
debt.
You a question, Minder? If you take them, as Maureen refers to, the amount of money got on the respite care, and it has come up on the programme quite a few times, why does the government take the view that if you are a PAYE person, you pay 7% at USC? And if you are a self-employed person who may be employing other people, paying PRSI, doing all those things which we need for the economy, they're the ones that are taxed at 10%. Like, why? There is a suspicion that it's because the senior civil servants are PAYE workers and they're involved in the decision-making, as indeed are the politicians. But, I mean, why would you militate against self-employed in that
there
way?
There is. There's always been that differential. It's
why?
To do, because the self-employed have more tax-deductible things they can claim. But, I mean, you're talking to somebody who, I don't think it's any secret now, was arguing for that increase. And that's the decision was a balance made by government in relation to these matters. And we have a settlement.
And what was the justification? I mean, if you take how you talk about building up indigenous business, that's where we need to get our money, that's the backbone of the economy. And for people who are employing other people, there seem to be tripwires all over the place.
Well, I mean, this whole budget was focused on as many supports as we could for small and medium enterprises, and you know, it was largely welcomed by that cohort of the economy, as you saw. But I know I thought, and I you know, we argued that there is capacity to increase the tax burden on those who can carry it most. But that there were the discussions,
particularly
and there was the
since we don't even call it tax.
But well, universal
it's not
social
a tax.
Universal,
sure, it's not.
Universal social charge is a tax.
Of
and
course, it is.
And
but it was
so. Just finish the point. Two things to say. One, it's a very progressive tax, in that it covers all income, and I think it's important from that perspective. But just to deal with Maureen's point, you know, I think it's something we really need to address, because one of the things that I find concerning, because I've been obviously at the coalface in looking line by line at public expenditure, and everything that is suggested in terms of a public expenditure reduction, everybody says, oh yeah, the target of 3.5 billion, Sinn Féin said, oh, you have to get that. Everybody says we have to get it. But any of the means we put forward, there's a flaw with, and it's never contextualised. We actually do value carers in this country, hugely. And if you look at, I can give you the chart. The chart right across the rest of Europe. I mean, if you look at, we haven't touched deliberately carers allowance, the weekly payment we give to carers. For people under 66, it's €204. For people over, it's €239. It's half again if they're caring for two people. The disallowances are very general. If you look at Northern Ireland, the carers allowance in Northern Ireland is £58. They don't have the supports we have. Now, that's not to say that, you know, that we can cut anything. We can't. But if
are
you are...
Are you getting the rumblings that we heard about there from Stephen, from your own party members?
My party, you know, is in the business of protecting social expenditure.
No, that's not what I asked you. Are you getting the rumblings from your members? I mean, there's talk now about two senators having a word with Joan Barton. I mean, are you just about holding your party together?
No, I mean, the party made a conscious decision after a debate. We walked through the doors of government understanding the level of burden that we're going to have to carry. I couldn't have been made clearer by the party leader, who said we'll be walking through a sea of placards. He said that. This was about rebuilding our country first. And bluntly, too often again and again in history, the Labour Party are the people who don't put either career, and when I read about, you know, careerist politicians and all the rest, career or party before our country. We need to recover our country and then we can start revisiting social expenditure. But if we destroy our country, it won't be, you know, the respite grant we'll be talking about. It'll be core payments to people who are absolutely dependent upon it. And the ultimate decision of the Irish people and their value judgment on us will be those who stick the course and deliver a recovered economy. And that's our challenge.
OK, I want to go to two other articles in the paper today. One is written by Colin McCarthy in the Sunday Indo. And I just recommend it to people. There's no great need to discuss the beginning of it. But he talks about, you know, quoting your man in the United States, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. And he goes on to say, if you stack $1 billion in $1 bills flat, one on top of the other, how high a pile do you think you'd get? Would it be as high as a tall skyscraper? Question mark. The answer is a pile roughly 12 times the height of Mount Everest. A billion is a lot of money. He then goes on to say, if you spread it out flat like a carpet, how much would be required for Croke Park, for the Phoenix Park, etc., etc., etc. And it just brings your head into focus about the kind of money we're talking about. But then he goes on to say that we've never got an answer to what happened in the banks. We never got an answer. The politicians, regulators, bankers, officials and advisors who misunderstood the nature of the crisis have not been properly held to account, but it's far greater omission not to have explored patiently and in public. So that's him putting in scale the debt. And then we go, now folks, this is really a scare at bedtime, to an article written by Shane Ross in the business section in the same paper today. And it's not the first time I've heard it, and people in that world have been saying it for quite a while, and it is enough to keep you awake at night. And it is to do with legislating, following a judgment by Justice Elizabeth Dunn about how we were to deal with debt, how we were to deal with personal debt, property debt, buy-to-let debt, and so on. And he concludes that bankers' pretense cannot continue indefinitely. Burying your head in the sand is not a policy. And he's basically saying that the level of debt that hasn't been written down by the banks, that they may come back to us looking for, is absolutely scary. Now, I don't know if I've paraphrased that.
No. I think the single biggest economic time bomb, to use that expression, that could go off in this country is the mortgage debt scenario. Okay, and it's primed to go off as incomes fall because taxes rise, and as growth falls because taxes rise, reducing growth opportunities.
Do you believe the banks have acknowledged that in their books?
The banks have raised 16 billion euros as part of the whole recapitalization to write down mortgage debt. This is what they've said. This is what they said last March. Now, what has happened is the banks are not writing down that. I believe it's because they don't believe that's enough. And nobody wants to be the bank boss
that goes back.
So the idea is that it's been like this since for a long time. I also believe the Irish banking crisis didn't begin 2009. It began in 2000 when they started lending money. John Stuart Mill, the English economist, said, you know, a crisis doesn't destroy wealth. It merely reflects the extent to which wealth has already been destroyed by bad investments. And this is exactly what's happened in Ireland. Now, if we don't solve the mortgage debt, personal debt issue, the economy won't grow. And if the economy doesn't grow, all the decisions that Brendan has to take and the government will become even more draconian. And then we will end up being the country that did all the right things, a la ECB, doesn't qualify, doesn't get out of the bailout because we didn't fix the debt. Now, the problem with debt is, and again, we come back to the basic issue. If a punter and a person living down, let's say outside Dublin, bought a place for 300,000 euros, which was not uncommon at all at the time. The place is now worth 120,000 euros, which is about the average of those three-bed houses out in the commuter belt. They've lost either one job in the family, if there were two of them working in the boom.
Yep.
What they cannot pay, they won't pay. not because they're unwilling to do so, but because they actually
haven't
can't.
Got
they
it.
Don't have the cash. That's the point.
The other point that he included in that article was about the buy-to-lets. Yeah. And that there has been a reluctance on the part of the courts to give them the go-ahead to repossess. But that when everybody starts facing up to the truth, there will be repossessions to the left, the right and the centre, and the property values will sink even further.
The Business Post is leading with that story this morning. Right. It's saying the banks are now preparing next year for the seizure of buy-to-lets. They're recruiting panels of insolvency and enforcement specialists ahead of a crackdown on distressed buy-to-let borrowers in the new year.
Let me just take three points before I talk on this. When, for example, and this is the paradox, it's in economics called the paradox of deleveraging, right? Which is selling an asset which isn't worth what you think it's worth. If the bank comes into me and says, you sell that buy-to-let flat you bought, okay, I say, all right, I'll do that. That is good for my balance sheet. But if everybody sells at the same time, what happens is all asset prices fall and the very effort to get out of debt actually puts you in more debt. And this is what the Business Post is talking about.
To deal with the 3 points. Firstly, Michael Noonan, in his budget speech, and he got some criticism for it, said the main issue facing our economy is debt. He put that at the heart of his analysis. And in truth, you know, if you look at each component part, mortgage debt, it's not so much the negative equity, it's the capacity to pay the mortgage. If you're in a good, comfortable job and you can pay it, it's very, very annoying and frustrating to be living in a house and paying a debt back that you can't ever get the value of, or at least in the foreseeable future. But at least, you know, that's a situation that's sustainable.
Your roof is secure.
Yeah. It is that cohort that cannot pay is the most worrying element of it. Now, when the BlackRock PCAR process took place last year, they did an analysis and they added on very significant additions to the viabilities of the banks to ensure that they were capitalised to deal with that cohort of debt. Now, our job as a government and to push the banks to deal with that. Now, we're bringing in the personal insolvency legislation. That's going through now.
Which the banks get a veto in.
Well, you
which
can't,
they do.
No. Wait a second.
You know, a spade is a spade.
You can't have a situation where everybody says, by the way, I can't pay. There has to be some level of engagement.
So what difference does it make? You're still dealing with the banks.
No. Let's deal
from the client's point of view.
It will come to a situation where people who are demonstrably, to a third-party external view, not in a position to pay, will be absolved of that debt. That is the reality of it.
All of their debt?
The debt that is not sustainable. But it's not going to be a charter.
If they own a buy-to-let?
Well, no, but I'll come to that separately, because there's two different issues. That's the first one.
Right.
The first objective of this government, and I think the first objective of every citizen, is to ensure that families retain the family home. And if you look at repossessions since this crisis started, they're tiny, certainly by anywhere in comparison, mm-hmm. because there is an absolute public policy to preserve that. That will be remain. Now, in terms of, let me deal with the buy-to-lets, there is a huge overhang of people who invested. Mm. I can buy 5 or 10 or 15 apartments.
Yeah, and some who just did it modestly for their pensions.
Yes, but we do need to have a functioning property market again. And in some instances, the best solution will be for foreclosure in those cases. And that has to be worked out through the system. But I want to return to one final point, and it's a point you made that nobody has talked about, and that is accountability. Because where are the bankers? Where are the policymakers that brought us to ruin? And why aren't they being held to account? And I can tell you, within the political system, there is that demand as well. Now, we tried to have a referendum on that.
Why was there a delay about setting up an inquiry? That's what I've never understood.
Because we needed, the advices we had is that after the Abilara judgment, we couldn't have the sort of investigative powers and the sort of decision-making that would actually assign blame that every other parliament in Europe has. We haven't got that constitutionally. We tried to fix that early on in this administration, and the people in their wisdom said no. So now I've drafted legislation within the constraints of the current constitution. That is now before an Oireachtas committee, so we can embark on this. But it is not where we'd rather be. We'd rather have much teethier, if you like, if that's a word at all, inquiry powers.
Why is John McGuinness experiencing resistance?
To what?
Well, one gets the feeling that he's experiencing resistance. Well, he has said so from within the civil service. about giving him the kind of information that he wants to run that PAC investigation?
Well, I'm not aware of any lack of information. The Public Accounts Committee is one of the most important committees of the House, gets any information it likes.
But we read out the reply, actually. It is constrained. As I recall, I read out the reply that the senior civil servant wrote back to Mr. McGuinness, and it was an exquisite piece of civil servant writing. They had it in the paper last week. But can I come back to what I think is the scare at bedtime? And even if a person never put a farthing into a buy-to-let, and Shane Ross is talking about, you know, that there's a kind of a collusion going on about not looking at reality and not looking at the write-downs that there should be in the bank. And he was saying, oh, perversely, they would drag their feet as they brandished the person and da-da-da. They would be terrified, this is the banks, that if even a tenth of the properties in arrears were put on the market, house prices would collapse even further. And then it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And then what would happen next? Yes, the Irish taxpayer would be called on again to pony up several extra billion to recapitalise the bank. So even if you didn't rent a dog kennel.
That's why at the very beginning of the programme, all roads lead back to the European Central Bank, OK? Because at the end of the day, to fix this, somebody has to foot the bill. And it's very, very clear that Draghi, and this is why I keep coming back to it, has changed and has said in the context of his own country, Italy, and in Spain, that he will involve himself in all sorts of financial gymnastics in order to make sure these countries do not default. And that's what he did over the last 8 or 9 months. Now, Shane is right in the sense that if there was nobody else, the Irish banks would run out of money again and it would be back to square one. But this is why, and this comes back to the negotiation, Ireland is in an interesting position because we are the only country that can possibly be put up as an example for the ECB, the Commission and the Troika as a success. So that is our strong card, OK? They do not want us to fail. Greece has failed. Spain would fail without Draghi. There's a big problem in France. We all know that, right? Monti in Italy has gone. Berlusconi is back. You know, this is what's
happening. With his new girlfriend.
So what I'm saying is that, and the reason Monti's gone is because austerity in Italy doesn't work. And the Italians said, we don't want this. And Monti is not for the job.
Can I ask you another question?
We can, there is a, for example, if this was, if Ireland, if the people involved in this, listening to the programme, who are in negative equity, were a company, they would do what's called a debt for equity swap. They'd go to the creditor and say, do you know what? We don't have the money. We can't afford the house. But if in 15 years' time you can sell the house, or 20 years' time you can sell the house, why not you own half of it now? And you then get
and
half
that, would
back.
Would that keep their balance sheet healthy?
Everyone's balance sheet healthy. The people could get on with their lives, which would be servicing half the mortgage, OK, and begin the process of recovery so they'd spend a little more money and then people would get a little bit more money. And then you have to say, who would then finance that bit between now and 15 years that the banks need finance? This is what Draghi hasn't suggested he's interested in doing, but has indicated in the way he's playing the game now that he is open to all sorts of financial creation. Yeah.
Can I ask you another thing?
It was a little bit simplistic.
But the internal problems.
The great thing about economics is what is complicated is rarely important,
and what is important is rarely complicated. This is really uncomplicated. There's a debt situation here. In the same way as a property bubble can burst,
we heard the point.
Debt bubble associated with the property bubble bursts, and if it does burst, we'll be in a much worse situation.
You're absolutely right. You're right on a number of fronts. One, we are the best candidate to recover, and we will recover if we steady the course, if we achieve the targets that we've set down and if we conclude the negotiations we're engaged in. And I'm confident on all fronts that we will do that. But the timeline is out there. I mean, in the middle of a negotiation, with all due respect, I'd rather get a success than satisfy somebody's curiosity today and put that success at risk. But let me just, Draghi, you're right. The transfer from Trichet to Draghi has been a very positive, from our perspective. There's much more flexibility and less rigour, and not to use that word lightly, a focus on a solution. But Draghi is one individual, subject to a board of, I'm going to say political masters, but they're not, they're independent central bankers. And you need...
Ish.
No, they're independent central bankers, and they are, I can tell you, and I deal with them very regularly, they're very jealous of their own position in terms of making those decisions. And you need to bring
them that's what I meant, like, because the German take the German line and the Spanish.
But, and they have, you know that the Germans are scarred by the notion of inflation. And because of their experience, they have migrated in to the euro and surrendered the Deutschmark with the greatest of reluctance on the basis that they are going to ensure that they don't devalue or undermine the basic strength of our currency, their currency.
How do they think that's possible? Let me
finish the point.
A union with Italy, a serial devaluer. Spain, a serial devaluer. Greece.
Well, you might say.
How did they expect
they'd
find a solution without them having to give ground? Germany didn't reunify Germany. Germany decided to get into bed with countries that are incapable of staying competitive with Germany in the Eurozone. We know that from the data. So what I can't understand is how the Germans can conceive that they joined a union
which will not change the nature of money. David, there's two separate dialogues, because you're going back to the history, genesis of the euro, which was a political project, as we know.
Yes.
It was a political project which has profoundly beneficial impact on the peoples of Europe, in as much as it brought peace. And we just have to look at the Balkans. You know, regression to savagery is not ancient
history. Well, now the European Union could have done that without the euro. I mean, the whole miracle of what happened was the Franco-German Pact. I mean, that led ultimately.
It happened when they'd all different currencies. They had 15 different currencies bouncing around the place. No, but my point is that there is a change. That Germans, it's kind of a philosophical thing. Germans believe that money is a common good, like fresh air, that should be protected by treaties and laws, and you can't change it. The rest of Europe believes that money is a tool to be used to move the economy when you're in a recession, out of a recession. So you've got a philosophical difference. But ultimately, Germany cannot and should not be allowed to allow its philosophy destroy the very project
Union. Yes, that's why we have to bring them with us, and that's what we've been engaged in for the best part of a year. And I said, I've instanced the successes we've chalked up, and I think you'll be, before we get to crunch time, we'll get that other success too.
Maureen.
Just to kind of bring it from the, the sort of higher reaches of economics back to the politics. I mean, what really strikes me is that there is, the people who are in debt, that is an extraordinary psychological burden for people, and I think it affects their behaviour in all kinds of ways. And what really strikes me is that I don't think they at the moment have any party that represent their interests. They're not an organised group. I mean, I know that there's, I've forgotten the name of that organisation
now
that's trying to help.
New Beginnings.
But, I mean, if you compare, say, the amount of airtime they get in comparison to the airtime of other lobby groups, I mean, it's minuscule. What I kind of feel is that this group of kind of stressed people are really disenfranchised. They feel very disenfranchised. And my own view would be that listening out there today, that people are far less interested in whatever internal sort of struggles are going on in Labour, than they are really in, do these people represent me? Are they coming up with compelling solutions? Do I believe that they care and they even know what my life
is like?
What
people want is a solution. They want to know that we're on a course.
They want to know people care about their problems.
I think Maureen's point is very valid. And when somebody's in here from FLAC, when somebody's in here from New Beginnings, they talk in not in economic terms, but in exactly those terms of the damage to society, of the level of stress and anxiety that people are coping with at the moment. And can I just add to their anxiety with one last question before the break. In this setting up of regulation across Europe that is being planned, is there also being planned the facility for banks finally to be wound down? And if that is so, if we have basket case banks here still, is there the possibility that those very banks also could be wound down?
The answer is yes to both questions. The European supervisory structure, which has now been agreed at political level within the Union, will ensure that the reckless policies, either reckless lending or borrowing that happened can't happen again.
Right. The reason I ask that is if what we're being told is the bottom line in the bank is a complete fantasy, just a little nervousness that after putting all that money into it and people and being wiped out by them, that they might just have to be closed down anyway.
No. I mean, the pillar banks are, and I think it's very important we say this, the pillar banks in this country are well-capitalised, they're well
functioning. No, they're not if they're lying
they're not.
About the amount of distressed debt.
No, wait a second now. An independent evaluation of that took place to a standard probably unmatched elsewhere in Europe. And they've determined the level of capitalisation and that money has been put in. So I think, you know, we don't want to add to people's woes and despair.
Right. OK. I'm going to have to take a break. It was a long time on that, but thank you very much indeed. With me in studio this morning, Minister Brendan Howland, David McWilliams, Maureen Gaffney, Tom McGurk and Stephen O'Byrnes.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, the other story that kind of knocked the stuffing out of people this week was the awful story about Shannon and Aaron Gallagher. And I see the priest being very critical of the society. The society has failed them. The state has failed them. All sorts of people have failed them. Maureen, what's your I mean, I know that this, everybody says don't be talking about it, because one of the problems is talking about suicide and how very prevalent it is at the moment nearly makes it an option.
Well, Marion, I would say take out the nearly, you know. I mean, we know that in the case of suicide, there are always personal factors, personal vulnerabilities, personal stresses. But that's not the whole story or anything like the whole story. A lot of teenagers who go through a very rough period, you know, come out the other end of it. There is a huge contagion effect. If, for example, a teenage boy has a friend in his social network, and I don't even mean a very close friend, I mean within the general network of friends, who commits suicide, his risk of thinking about suicide the following year triples, and his actual risk of trying suicide goes up by 2.5 times. And with girls, the risk is slightly less. There's a huge amount of analysis, scientific analysis of this contagion effect, you know, for example, in the US. And you can document scientifically that when you have a suicide, particularly one that gets an awful lot of dramatic media attention.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, people have to report, obviously, but there is a huge amount of drama about things. And even the very well-intentioned things, you know, like the town wants to come together and, you know, they have guards of honour and, you know, speeches
which
and sermons and so on.
Which looks very attractive to somebody who doesn't
understand.
And the
problem is that and this is actually documented, Marion, the problem is that gives it even further power. It really feeds the contagion, you know. So what you get is that you get teenagers, you know, who have the average run-of-the-mill problems, you know, grievances and setbacks and disappointments and love affairs breaking up and all the bullying, all the rest of it. And they see themselves literally, as it were, up in the sky, looking down at this great drama unfolding, and that then they'll be vindicated. They don't actually know they will not be looking down. They'll be dead, you know. And so it's a huge issue. I mean, there's a whole school of thought, you know, that media reporting on suicide has to change dramatically because you do have this independent contagion effect.
Right.
Extraordinary piece in the Mail today by Sebastian
Hamilton. Yes, I have it here, yeah.
About his mother who committed suicide when he was 2.5. It is one of the most powerful and compelling pieces of journalism I've ever read, telling how his whole life ever after cannot escape from that moment.
Well, funnily enough, we were talking to him this morning, and when he heard of those two, he said he just went into a room and he wrote that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece.
For the benefit of the listeners,
it's page 23 of the Mail today, and there's a paragraph here in the piece. He said, I also missed out and what it's like to have the love of a mother and the love a mother gives a child. I never even knew it existed. I had no idea that mums made breakfast. I thought you did this for yourself. I didn't know that mums tucked you in at night, drove you to matches, brought you a cup of tea, consoled you when some girl broke your heart, listened to your day. I used to think I was remedially stupid because I was alone. And he goes on to talk about what the impact of his mother's suicide when he was 2.5 has had on his
entire life.
And he
also says, I didn't fully appreciate the absolute emotional holocaust that it had wreaked on me, on my father, my brother, my grandfather, my grandmother, my uncle, my cousins. Terrible consequences for each and every one of us, many of which can never be undone. Bonds that should be loving have been smashed, shattered beyond any hope of repair. Stephen.
Marion, I mean, to ask Maureen perhaps, I mean, how do you then resolve the dilemma at the core of what she has just said? Namely, as you know, that we need to talk about it.
He's saying we need to talk about it.
He says it very strenuously.
But Maureen has also reminded us that in talking about it, you actually potentially offer it as a solution to vulnerable youngsters.
Well, there's two things. One is that there's no easy solutions to this. I mean, let me say that, you know. But the media have a duty to report facts. But there are certain guidelines now that, say, psychologists who study this would suggest that, the reporting should be factual, you know, rather than dramatic. And also, I would add that that sort of account this morning, that heartbreaking account, is the kind of thing you need to get into it rather than the analysis, for example, of causes particularly.
Because what
people don't realise, one of the things that happens to people right before they commit suicide is that they go into this kind of tunnel vision and they don't see or even think of the consequences for those
that are
left
behind.
Okay,
can I just read out another reason? Who triggered this? Whose fault is it? Who's to blame? Yeah. And he also goes on to say the answer is always, always nobody. But he also says that the thing about we have to stop lying about suicide, we need to stop pretending that somebody died unexpectedly or accidentally fell off, etc., etc., etc. And I was reading what the priest said at the Mass yesterday. Very critical of the government, very critical of the HSE, and very critical about, as it were, the absence of a strategy of how to handle this.
I think that government and the HSE and everybody else, no more than society, you know, it's at a loss to have an absolute strategy to deal with this. You know, people talk about the amount of money we pay, we give into road safety, but it's not something you can award penalty points or have a sort of enforcement. This is extremely complicated, and I think we need the national conversation and people like Maureen in particular, because I remember being at a very sad funeral of a victim of suicide. And I remember the priest talking about, well, the person is no longer in pain. He's with the angels. And it is, I don't know, is that, you need to console, not only the bereaved, the heartbroken, the shattered people that are there.
But you need to focus on the living. There are
other people who are hearing this, you know, I'm in pain. Is that person no longer in pain? Is the agony over? How do we have that?
Tell me, you want to come in?
We've got to remember that Connecticut was a suicide. I mean, 26 people died in the process.
And indeed, the nurse in the hospital in London, where the Duchess was.
You mentioned something interesting morning about the media. Now Connecticut has turned into the big show on American television. It'll run for days and days and days. And suddenly it becomes some sort of grotesque entertainment almost.
Yeah, well, we'll be talking about it later in the programme. In the context of guns.
Media coverage. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right.
The minister has brought up a very interesting point, because I've often been uncomfortable when you read the newspaper reports, particularly even the kind of thing that the minister has just referred to in terms of the priest's ceremony.
But it doesn't
challenge the fact of the suicide. And again in these reportages, you'll see particularly, say, Facebook tributes to somebody who has committed suicide. But it's always gushing and it's always, you know, warm and cuddly. Like, you never see themes about, like, that was a selfish act. This you should not have done to your family.
And who was it? It was a politician, Jim McDade, when he said it. He got nearly slaughtered. He did.
Absolutely. You know? Now, I know he did. I think he was actually very well intentioned at the time.
Yes, I believe so.
But, you know, he was literally slaughtered. I mean, there was a totally irrational response. Because in a way, I mean, I won't go into the circumstances of that Sebastian's mother's death because it's just too horrible.
Just too yeah.
But I mean, if that could be, as it were, eliminated from it, every single teenager in the country should be made read that, you know, because it is really the focus has to be
and
on
he
the
talks
absolute
about the pain yeah.
that's inflicted,
and
that is
lifelong, which is really but powerful. He's on the inside of this.
I'm reading on page 13 of the Sun, which covers the Father Joe Duffy's speech, the sermon, and he's saying society has failed the children and the two sisters within months. My heart is devastated, and then he. Then he goes on to talk about the state and what we could do. But it seems to me that this is just the reaction of somebody who is so devastated and traumatised and angry. People, you know, we get angry when these things happen around us, that it's almost quite an understandable response from a community leader to project outside the community, initially at least.
And blame.
Well, initially at least, to try and take the weight off the community themselves. And I know
clearly the state had been involved, because I hadn't realised until this morning that the little girl was in was in foster care. So obviously there was engagement with the state, and somehow it must have gone. Is this regarded as a priority or just another headache, really?
Oh, God, no. I mean, suicide is now one of the biggest killers. I'm probably the biggest killers of young people.
Yeah.
It is. We
bigger
need,
than road accidents.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because we've had such success in dealing with road accidents. We've changed behaviours. So we need a strategy. There's no doubt about it. And if it was a matter of resources, we'd find resources. It's just too important. But
I think one issue, though, is that given that we have very good evidence, and I mean, I think that's very dramatic evidence about the scale of contagion, you know, the risk factors, you know, is that there has to be, I think, once there is that kind of, you know, very dramatic clustering, I mean, of suicides, there needs to be an area-based response. In other words, there needs to be the equivalent of a SWAT team go into that community for a while, because their risk is far, far higher than it is. Now, this is hard to do because you don't want to be adding to the drama either. But you know, it is a difficult thing. But certainly the risk is now higher.
Could you go around the schools and talk about it?
People do, I think. No, I mean, there's some very, very... There's
would
some
that be a good idea?
Yeah, but I think, you see, the
you'd
the
need
issue,
to get your tone right, I presume.
You would, yeah.
Well, I think,
you would.
For fear of actually prompting the very contagion of the speaker.
Yeah, because the problem is that once you introduce what seems to happen, we don't fully know how it happens, but what seems to happen is that it's introduced as an option into your menu of responses.
You see, in the past, it wasn't reported. And then there was a big discussion about it and decided that it should be reported.
Yeah.
And I suppose we never quite figured out.
But also, you know, again, we've gone from one extreme to the other. Yeah. The church used to have an extremely punitive aspect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you couldn't be buried in consecrated ground.
Right.
Now, I know
that
was awful for families, but we've now gone to the other extreme.
Last word to you, Minister, before we go to the newsroom.
I mean, I think we do need to have the conversation. But I think, you know, those of us who are not expert in this area are reluctant to know what to say or what to do. What is
the right
thing? I mean, we need to structure that now. And I think it's beyond a health issue. It's not just a HSE issue.
No.
We need to have a societal dialogue about this now and hopefully have a strategy that we can agree on to minimise what is an extraordinary hemorrhaging of valuable lives from our community.
OK, Minister, thank you very, very much indeed for that. I know that you are leaving us now. And thank you indeed for joining us in the first place. And now we're going to go to the newsroom and Michael Murphy.